Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is The Takeaway from Monday, August 7th, 2017. This is John Hockenberry's last week. If you have a goodbye message for him, please give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm John Hockenberry. And 10 years ago or so, I and some spectacularly gifted radio producers started a program that was dedicated to the idea that though far from power, we in public media could mobilize the power of knowledge and thinking and deep conversation to make people more engaged in this American democracy. Take this issue from the Obama years.
We know that even as we imprison more people of all races than any nation in the world, an African-American child is roughly five times as likely as a white child to see the inside of a prison.
And now the very different era we're in these days.
When you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head, and they've just killed somebody. Don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Two presidents with very different ideas in this case about the U.S. criminal justice system. As we put this program together each day and hear your voices in our national conversation, we are dedicated to this idea that knowledge and deep thinking are powerful forces for change. And as part of my last week being the facilitator of this experiment in public media's contribution to democracy, we're going to return to this issue of the U.S. criminal justice system.
I think many people do not know that the United States, 5% of the world's population we have here, but yet we have almost 25% of the world's prisoners.
Right now, our sentencing laws are actually not based on public safety. They're based on what people guessed would be an appropriate punishment.
What we're seeing, you know, we have approximately just under 29,000 inmates who are refusing state-issued meals, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not eating.
Policymakers on both sides of the aisle are realizing that there are more effective and less expensive ways to deal with nonviolent offenders.
Voices from our extensive coverage of this issue on The Takeaway. Almost, while we weren't looking, although in some communities there was nothing else to look at, our prison system and criminal justice system have become an unsustainable circus of plea bargains, jail time, waiting for trials, excessive sentencing, a racially targeted system of incarceration, at least in effect, if not always in intent. It has taken big ideas and the boldness of policymakers free of political handcuffs to look at real reform and to try to get the U.S. system on a reform track. The Vera Institute has embarked on a national experiment to re-examine mass incarceration in this country and its failings, with the aim to find solutions and to produce an action plan. Nicholas Turner is president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice, and he explains how it took a trip to, of all places, Germany, to see an enlightened justice system in action to stimulate an active rethinking of the prison system in the United States.
Life in prison in Germany is made to look as much as possible as life on the outside because of the recognition that people will have to succeed on the outside. So there's a real commitment to autonomy. There's a real commitment to sort of the normalization of process, to solving problems in a way that you would solve them on the outside. People wear their own clothes. They are called their names. They're not called a number. They're able to cook. They're able to decorate their cells, which really should be called rooms. They have keys to their rooms. I mean, so there's a respect for privacy. And
that's at all level of crime, violent crime?
Yes.
And really?
Yes. The levels of violence were very low in the facilities, and the level of positive problem-solving interaction between the security officials and the people who were locked up was remarkable. And so that was very eye-opening.
That is amazing. So there's a strong rehabilitation component built in to the whole German notion of corrections.
It is not just a strong component. It is the reason for its very existence. And you see it when you speak to corrections administrators, and you see it when you speak to the officers, and you see it in every facet of life in prison in Germany.
But as you look at the prison system across the United States, say a Texas or a Louisiana, what would be the hardest nut to crack, the hardest challenge to try to begin that same level of experimentation and enthusiasm?
Let me say, you know, that we're seeing experimentation all over the country.
So my assumptions even there are beginning to be obsolete.
Well, but entirely understandable. You know, a lot of what people worry about in this moment, in this administration, where it seems like we've returned to the rhetoric of tough on crime and law and order and sort of a more punitive approach, is that that might be what's on the airwaves. But what is happening all over the country, because this the criminal justice system is 90% state and local, is that there are ambitious, you know, value-driven public leaders all over the country who are trying to do new things. So, you know, at Vera, we are working with 10 correctional administrators in states like Louisiana and Utah, and then also, you know, Minnesota and New Jersey. But they are all making a commitment to figure out how they can reduce the use of solitary confinement. They know that the systems have relied for too long on this as a disciplinary measure or as a punishment, and that it doesn't make people any better.
No, we've covered that. It's well known, and it's great to hear that realization is beginning to become programs in particular states.
And a real appetite for change. I mean, enough so that the way we've done things at Vera is that we now hold competitions and states apply. It's like a race to the top, and they compete to work with us so that they can make these changes. You know, I think that reform is really alive and well at the state and local level. But how does that happen in a, at a much broader scale? And I think that's what I would describe as big, powerful drivers of the criminal justice system that we have now. The matter of racism, which is still to this day when there are many people in America who are persuaded to take a tough on crime approach and to vote for folks who pursue draconian sentences because their vision of dangerous people is a young black man. And that vision is something that has been nourished by the media and by politicians and by the rhetoric that politicians use, so that that sort of racist and racialized instinct is, you know, still alive and well in many parts of America. And we have to come to terms with that. I mean, one of the things—
How do the Germans do it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting, you know, because they get the same thing. There are tabloids in Germany. There are, you know, there are people who have been released from prison who have done bad things, and that ends up in the press, and then people scream and shout and get mad, and, you know, and there are two things about Germany that are different. One is that prosecutors, corrections officials, they're all not elected. So they don't respond to the rage of the, you know,
moment.
Public in the moment in the same way that our elected officials tend to do. And then there's something in a way, you know, this peculiarly professional and, you know, in Germany, this commitment to craft and to the very seriousness of the work, so that this recognition that everything that they need to do is about helping people to succeed on the way out, and that if they haven't succeeded, then that's a failure for them to really reflect on.
It's separate, this idea of anger and the system that is going to deal with criminals.
They'd
and,
say,
and
of, course, people get angry. That's what people do. And of course, the tabloids are going to write about it. But our job is to make sure that that we can protect public safety. And the way we protect public safety is by doing everything we can to help that person succeed.
I wonder if you could take me through what you envision as we think about people really taking tangible steps that will get us excited and will communicate the idea that, hey, this is doable.
Right. Imagine this, a series of conversations with crime victims, with people who have been incarcerated, with corrections administrators, with corrections officers, with law enforcement, with advocates on the left and advocates on the right, essentially saying, if you had a chance to start anew, to start afresh and construct a system of criminal sanction, what would it look like and what are the values that underlie it? Like, what's the very purpose of it? And so we're really trying to have those breakthrough conceptual conversations with all of these groups and people who are very concerned, I mean, who have a stake in the criminal justice system. And they are informing a vision that will really paint a picture for what this justice system and what prisons ought to look like, not tomorrow, but as a reference point in the future, you know, decades into the future. We've already decided that it's important for us to reduce the prison population, but now we have to think about the point of prison.
You know, just to push back, because this is a moment where we thought, you know, we were on the same page politically, and maybe we aren't so much. And the surprises of the November election suggest that, and you've alluded to some of those ideas already, suggest that there are people out there, well-meaning people out there, who would listen to this conversation and would go, look at that. There's the media just trying to be soft on criminals. And I've never been so infuriated in my life. What would you say to such a person? And what would you hope they might hear if they go out and rant in public about what they heard you talking about on this radio station?
You know, we have a system of justice to ensure safety for all of us. The question is, well, how does that system interact with people to maximize our collective safety? And what America and Americans have done is bought a bill of goods for the past few decades that long sentences, degradation, aggressive policing, and locking people up for long periods of time, that's what produces safety. And most people have bought it. The statistics tell you otherwise, and the evidence tells you otherwise. And so if you begin the conversation, say, look, so this should be a system that is going to deliver you and me maximum safety. What does it need to look like? And you follow what we know about what is not working with the system currently and what we know is working about other systems, then it leads to a conclusion that degradation and maltreatment and an excess of punishment is actually not serving us.
So you very quickly get to the point of, why not try something that's working, that's cheaper, and that you can see it working? And what would be so wrong with that?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think
– how do you respond to the person that then says, hey, that may be the case, but crime feels bad to me and it makes me angry and I want those people to be hurt? How does that not contribute to public safety?
You know, what I've seen that's quite different than what I saw 5 years ago or 10 years ago is that leaders of big public agencies that are supposed to deliver public safety are now saying, the public is asking me to do something different. They're asking me to reform my system. They're asking me to figure out how I can create program or policy that is actually going to produce a better outcome. And they're owning that in a way that is, you know, so, again, something that didn't exist 10 years ago or 20 years ago and that wouldn't be rewarded. But now it's rewarded. So I do think that we are moving. It gets a little bit blotted out by the, you know, what's tweeted or what's said in the 24-hour news cycle. But
Beneath the noise. Positive sounds.
Absolutely. One of the things that has been most powerful to me is that people who have been victims of violence, people who have survived crime, are becoming some of the most powerful voices for system reform, because they're saying, look, we've seen the history of this. We have seen what we have done over the past few decades, and locking people up for long periods of time isn't working. It's not making me any safer. I want a different kind of accountability. I want them to acknowledge that they've done something wrong, but I don't think prison is the answer. And we're seeing that all over the country. Absolutely. Progress beneath the noise.
Nick Turner is president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice. Nick, thanks so much.
John, thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you.
We'll bring you more on what people and institutions are doing to help reimagine prison tomorrow on The Takeaway. For North Korea, getting the attention of the world is literally rocket science. A missile launch over the weekend brought a quick response in the UN Security Council.
The price the North Korean leadership will pay for its continued nuclear and missile development will be the loss of one-third of its exports and hard currency. This is the most stringent set of sanctions on any country in a generation.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley speaking on Saturday as the U.N. Security Council, including China and Russia, voted unanimously to approve new economic sanctions. Is the goal of the U.S. drafted sanctions to cut North Korea's $3 billion export revenue by a third strong enough? Stephen Nerper is a senior director with the Korea Society and an adjunct professor at Columbia University.
The biggest concern really has to do with the pacing of their technology and improvements in their nuclear and their missile capabilities. So things are happening very fast, and they have developed a much longer range for their missiles. They seem to be making progress on other fronts. And the big question mark is, are they able to miniaturize? Can they put a nuclear payload at the tip of that missile? Can it withstand reentry? And it seems that they're going in that direction. And the fear is that that may be the case by next year.
And the important thing to note is that what they're doing now, 5 to 10 years ago, we sort of assumed they would never be able to,
right.
to do.
We never fathomed that. No one thought that they would be able to get this far, especially because there have been 8 rounds of sanctions that have been put in place designed to curtail that. And the North Koreans continue to surprise us. In 2010, they surprised us with centrifuges. In the last year now, they have tested twice nuclear, and they have tested missiles over 24 times in 2016, multiple times this year. The problem is they're showing improvements in rocket thrust and other capabilities.
So the joke era on Kim Jong-un is over, and the question of do sanctions actually work is a serious question posed even despite the activity at the Security Council.
Well, that's right, John. Do they work and do we have enough time for them to work? Because the rapidity of the improvements in technology mean that the threat is growing. And they do have the capability, it appears now with this July 4th and July 28th test, to at least put the United States within range. So they've got the distance thing figured out. The accuracy, that's another question, but it's a very serious threat. And so the Security Council resolutions are designed to curtail that. Is there enough time for them to take effect?
And we can say sanctions, schmanctions with the particular wording in the Security Council, but I was really struck by the forthrightness and candor of the Chinese representative in the Security Council. How did you assess that?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I think China stepped up. They have co-sponsored the last 2 rounds of resolutions. This is the 3rd set of resolutions in 18 months, but these have the most serious teeth to them. And they also have Russian backing as well. So they hit North Korea at some very key places, including exports. And the estimate is that they'll affect 1/3 of North Korean exports, over $1 billion.
Now, in a country that is run like, some have said a concentration camp, what would be the signs? What would be the indications that sanctions are working, that the sting is enough for the government to alter its behavior on this question of missile development and nuclear program?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing we would see is probably North Korea agreeing to come to the negotiating table, which is exactly what they're intended to do. There are other possibilities of things that would signal growing instability or disenchantment on the economic front, restive behavior in the marketplaces, reports of action among people, or perhaps the elite acting more. There has been a widespread purge that's taken place since Kim Jong-un's been in.
Do we have the intelligence capability to monitor those factors that you've described?
Well, U.S. and South Korean intelligence does their best, but we don't have senior-level contacts to the degree that one would like. And so part of the idea is how to read North Korea, and that's a continued process for a lot of analysts who take a look daily at what's happening.
And the read has totally changed. I can remember David Sanger from the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So who's covered North Korea for years and years and years on this program, saying that the routine is old school, that the North Koreans try to get the West's attention. They do, and then they get some sort of economic benefit from it. They get reward for curtailing bad behavior that they did for a while. It seems like the pattern has radically changed now.
Well, it's radically changed in that they have reached a level, especially with this newer leader he's been in since 2012, Kim Jong-un, that they are expressing a level of confidence. And their confidence, their attitude is one where that doesn't look like they're rushing for talks with the United States, nor do they seem to care as much about the international community. They're pretty small entity that is very inward-looking, and it's a totalitarian regime. They've managed to survive a lot, including a famine in the 1990s. So that's another aspect of the sanctions. Can they bite enough for a regime that's recalcitrant and isolated?
Broadly, looking at the behavior of Kim Jong-un, do you believe his mission is simply to gain a kind of global attention? It doesn't necessarily seem as though he wants to destabilize the Korean Peninsula, which would be another very, very serious military mission.
Right. And destabilizing the peninsula would mean bringing the Chinese in. It would mean major power conflict. So what he's probably trying to do, right, is to gain legitimacy both in the eyes of his own population as well as in from the international community. And so going nuclear is how he feels he can do that. And he feels that the stakes are high and that the Americans will pay to some degree to get to the table, and that once they're at the table, they can negotiate a peace regime, which ultimately means their desire to see the Americans off of the Korean Peninsula and ultimately still in their doctrine to reunite Korea under North Korean leadership, which is a very different way than the world sees it.
Stephen Nerber is senior director with the Korea Society and an adjunct professor at Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
There were no injuries, luckily. But a bomb that went off inside the imam's office at the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota on Saturday morning struck at the heart of a community's sense of peace and tolerance.
If this were roles were reversed, and it would be called a terrorist attack. And that's what it is. It's an act of terrorism, a criminal act of terrorism against the imam, who, thank the good Lord, was not present in his office, as it would appear that this person intended.
That's Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton speaking outside the Islamic Center over the weekend. It's now a crime scene for what is being called a hate crime with an active investigation underway. For more, we go now to Stephen Montemayor, a reporter for the Star Tribune in Minnesota.
Fairly soon after the explosion was first reported, at least from law enforcement on Saturday, you could start to see a pretty large outpouring of actually people physically present outside the Islamic Center. Definitely reverberated throughout both the local Somali American community, which is quite large in Minnesota, and also the interfaith community and the community at large. Roughly, a few hours after the news started to spread, we began to see local, just Minnesotans of all stripes showing up with signs of support. It was definitely something that rocked a lot of people.
And the governor described this as a terrorist attack. It's being investigated, of course, as a hate crime. Describe, first of all, the nature of this Islamic center and any other message that might have come from this attack.
It's a very large center. Just as recently as a few months back, there was a interfaith dinner there that held about several hundred people. The explosion itself occurred very early in the morning, before dawn, at a time in which about a dozen people would be gathering to pray, and it's used as a place of worship, a community center, and also a daycare site.
You get the sense in the response that you've described that people in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota very much, or at least a constituency there, very much doesn't want this to spiral into some greater pattern of violence. Given that when we've covered the story of Muslims in the Minnesota community, the issue of being visible or not being visible has often been an issue among families, this really raises that issue for Somalis and others who are Muslims in the Twin Cities, does it not?
Yeah, it's to the point of visibility. There are a few places that are more visibly a part of the Muslim community than an Islamic center, and there has been a persistent concern. We reported earlier this year that anti-Muslim hate crimes or bias incidents have been on a pretty steady climb upward, while other categories have kind of trended downward in Minnesota.
Is there any sense that this is a part of the process of a community growing in a place like Minnesota, and that as it gets more visible, you see these sorts of unfortunate incidents, but that ultimately you'll get past it and this will be more of a coexistence? Or Is there some really dark, dark force at work here that's going to raise the stakes?
There's two things at play. There's the outpouring of support, and then on the other hand, you have the actor behind this attack. And in addition to that, we've also seen quite a bit of online trolling for the local Council on American Islamic Relations Facebook page. And I think this is more difficult to quantify at this moment, you know, those dark forces.
Well, the tension is certainly tangible there in the Twin Cities. Stephen Montemayor is a reporter for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
And now the story of a mother's lonely efforts to keep her son on track, growing up in a challenging environment of poverty, drugs, and urban violence. Mother's efforts that came to a terrible end in December of 2015.
When the figure, began to walk off, I knew that walk. Mario, somewhat pigeon-toed, had a kind of sluggish walk to him. I knew it was him.
Gwen Woods is the mother of Mario Woods. He was killed after being shot more than 20 times by several San Francisco police officers. His mother discovered her son on a gruesome video of the shooting on Facebook several hours after it happened, and her struggle became trying to hold back the terrible truth.
Instinctively, I knew it was him. I knew his mannerism. I knew his walk. But subconsciously, I didn't want to own that,
It was the Bayview neighborhood of San Francisco, where Gwen raised Mario and his brothers as a single parent with two jobs, struggling to keep him safe and on track.
We owned our stuff. I always say we own it. You own your stuff. I would say consequences of behavior is what it is. So the consequences of, him having to do 17 to 25, at Folsom Prison. But I'm there with you. Weekends, I'm here with you. Because I want you to really, really trust that you're going to be okay.
At 16, it was a year in juvenile detention. 2 years later, 7 years in Folsom State Prison for attempted robbery. His mother visited him every weekend until he was paroled in September of 2014. He began to use meth. He entered a rehab program in the city and started taking classes to earn his high school diploma. When he got his driver's license, he bought a used green Camaro and started working part-time. Had he turned things around?
I always called it for Mario, your proverb years, Mario. You get through them. And then finally, when you get some wisdom, life would just be greater. Should have been allowed to make it through the proverb years.
But in the afternoon on December 2nd, 2015, San Francisco police received a call reporting a stabbing. The police spotted Mario with a knife near the location, and the incident ended in the worst way.
They shot at Mario 41 times. His body took 21 bullets, only one from the front, the 20 from the back.
Gwen Woods, Mario's mother, went from her private struggle to save her son to a very public role as a victim of a police shooting. Her voice joined the very public symbols of this national issue, the family of Michael Brown from Ferguson and others from Baltimore, New York, Cleveland, and Chicago.
We're all at that mercy, And I think every black mother, every black father, and brown mothers and fathers live with that, I just to pray that, with all my sons, please just keep them protected. And maybe the harsh part of it is that you more so think the streets will be where these things happened from the community violence. I really didn't think I'd see what I saw in the video come from police officers that are supposed to serve and protect a community.
Did you see your son's body eventually?
They had washed Mario up so fast, they tell me, rinsed his blood off the sidewalk. When I went back there, I could see the stains of where his blood was, where his blood ran out. I remember, just by chance, I was looking at something, and the picture of him and the bullet wound to the back of his head. And I just remember, as his mother, thinking, he just had this beautiful hair. He just was this... And I just think, it took such a plug out of his head, And I thought, that's so inhuman. That just can't. I tend not to be able to deal with those pictures or the image of when you see him in that position. But sometimes just, by mishap, there it is, I do have moments where I think, I should have went to the coroner's just to hold him one more time. When he was in his coffin, he was so fragile. His body was so annihilated. It was so just wrecked that you couldn't even kiss him.
San Francisco journalist Jaya Lee got to know Gwen Woods, the mother of police shooting victim Mario Woods, shortly after his death, and decided she would follow a mother's struggle after an event that for a moment was so public, but which eventually fades into a lifetime of loss and questions. Jaya Lee spent 17 months with Gwen and wrote about her experience for the magazine California Sunday this weekend. After the shooting, A Year in the Life of Gwen Woods, it's called. It was an experience that changed both of their lives.
When I first heard about the shooting of Mario Woods, I was sitting in my newsroom at my desk, and I had been covering cases like this since Ferguson. And one thing that always nagged me in the process of covering these stories was that I knew there was an absence of the family's voice. And I became very curious to find out what happened in the months that followed and to remind people that there is a life afterward, and it's not pretty.
Gwen, a lot of people look at stories like this where individuals may have had difficulty growing up, and that somehow there's a pathway to this moment of destiny, in this case, tragedy, and that at all points, Mario was on his way to this moment where he was shot down by the San Francisco police or by the police. You can't possibly see it that way, right?
No, and I beg to differ. I don't think anyone could possibly see it this way, because we have to also talk about the two policing of black and brown and the policing of white men. When I saw the video, just the first part of Mario in this uncompromising position, what instinctively came to my mind is that, they did it. San Francisco did it. So, no, I think your job is to apprehend, take into custody, let my child tell his side of the story. If you felt like he needed to be behind bars, I can go visit him behind bars instead of a cemetery. And in the manner that it was done, it was clearly shown he wasn't a threat.
Jeb, how did Gwen make the transition from mother to grieving mother to activist?
Gwen was thrust into the public spotlight the moment her son was shot and killed. And she was both grieving and trying to navigate this new space of what it meant to be a mother who suddenly lost her son, and not only lost her son, but in this very public, brutal way. I think in part because of Ferguson, there was already a lot of public attention on this issue. And Gwen sort of became this sudden pseudo-celebrity in some ways. And it's something that no parent would ever want to do, a position they never would want to be in. So I sensed from the beginning this sort of reluctance, but at the same time, appreciation for the amount of attention that her son was getting. And for the year that would follow, this continuing navigation of what it meant to be in this space.
Gwen, are you a good activist?
No. You know, it's always odd when people say that. I always say I'm Mario's mom. Always been Mario's mom. Even through, you know, our struggle years. And I still say that today. When I came out the gates, I knew I couldn't lay down and die in grief because I had to be his voice, because they were going to demonize him. I knew it. I knew who he was. He made some knucklehead choices. But that's 16, 17. So I knew that I couldn't just roll over. I had to be his mother, still his mother. You know, even in the worst moment of my life, I still had to be his voice and say who he was and at the core of him and what his soul was like.
What was it like, Gwen, comparing notes about being the voice of someone you loved and lost with the mother of Michael Brown or Eric Garner or Sandra Bland or Tamar Rice?
I think we all know that we know them better than the world. And who could speak better for them than their mom? And so I think we all have that in common. You have to run out the gate fighting. You can't even begin to grieve. And I even ask myself to this day, I don't even think I've begun grieving, you know.
What's this group of moms like? I mean, you would never have met these people but for this terrible tragedy. Are you a sisterhood? Are you a—
It is a sisterhood. And I think what happens and what I realized, I went to the Trayvon Martin Foundation Mothers Conference, and you connect and you look at one another and you realize the mothers that went before you and they're still standing. And you realize you're going to stand too. But you're not in denial of that. This great loss is an everyday struggle. I remember I heard Michael Brown's mom say, just the idea of, can we see our children's executioners, look them in the eye? And unfortunately, I always say this now, the audacity of being a black or brown mother, the justice may not be there. I had to look at something, and I heard something that Marilyn Mosley, the DA of Baltimore, in the case of Freddie Gray. And though she didn't get a conviction, she did say, I have to look at that glass half full. So whatever policies have changed to make it better for someone else, then we've won. Whatever changes San Francisco are making that may save a life, okay, cost me everything, but we have to kind of find solace in that. So I think the commonality of mothers in these cases, I think we all maybe understand we may not get justice, but we should be able to look those officers in the eye.
Look them in the eye.
Yeah, look them in the eye.
What would you say?
I'd say, just know what you've done to my world. I've done a lot to survive, to make life work. And one of the reasons that I would get up in the morning, you just took it away from me. Just obliterated it.
Well, thanks to both of you for spending this time and sharing really an amazing story and a story of an aftermath that doesn't get told.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Gwen Woods is the mother of Mario Woods, who was shot and killed by San Francisco police in 2015. Jay Lee followed Gwen for 17 months to tell her story. It appears in the latest issue of the magazine, California Sunday.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America.
We end this hour thinking about the persistent controversy over immigration policy in America. The long delay in making clear how this country will deal with people who have been here for decades without legal status has recast the definition of who is an American. Does growing up here count? Raising a family here count? If nothing about you is American except your citizenship papers, does that matter? If your U.S. birthright is measured in generations, yet you openly support white supremacy and racial exclusion, does that make your claim to be an American questionable?
I grew up believing this country was founded for people who were looking for freedom of choice.
I am so grateful for our Constitution. Constitutional law and our judicial checks and balance system is what has kept America, America.
One skin color doesn't make one American. America stands for generosity, loyalty, and togetherness.
For me, being a true American means embracing all cultures, languages, and religions, and also respecting that not everyone has the same values and opinions I do.
American identity is constantly evolving. It is not a fixed point, which apparently makes a significant number of us uncomfortable.
What does it mean to be American enough, we asked. You would think Vikram Iyer, a former senior policy advisor to President Barack Obama and former chief of staff for the U.S. Patent Trademark Office, would not really have to ask himself this question. But not only does he ask it, he's made exploring the idea of being American enough the theme of a new podcast out this week. Vikram says how people talk about who is American is a direct consequence of American political leadership at any given moment. So are some Americans confident in being American enough, and other Americans suddenly wonder if they're coming up short?
It's a great question, and I'm going to start with what might sound like a pretty silly analogy, but did you ever watch that show on NBC, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
Yes.
So we all know the character Carlton comes from one background in Beverly Hills, and his cousin Will comes from a different background in, I think, West Philadelphia. And in that, at a later point, they're both rushing the same fraternity in college, and one of them kind of gets poo-pooed, Carlton, for being a little too country club, a little too rich in his upbringing, and this community was trying to find out folks that the show was trying to call, you know, what was black enough, you know, are you actually from the grit and resilience and backstory of what being black in America means.
Will, Carlton doesn't exactly exemplify what I think a Phi Beta Gamma is.
Oh, and what is that?
Well, it's not Ralph Lauren shirts and wingtip shoes in corporate America. We don't need a brother like him in this fraternity.
And I use that analogy because Carlton, in response to not being admitted to this fraternity, ends up saying, black is who I am, not what I'm trying to be or not who I'm trying to be. And so I think whether you're an immigrant in this country or whether you're born in this country, whether you're a college student or you're a senior citizen, whether you're a veteran or not, whether you're gay or not, any type of binary that we try and create among different types of individuals, we celebrate a complexity of that diversity by having one common denominator, and that is we all start from a basic premise of being American, because America is inherently defined by all of those attributes, all of those values, and all of those people.
Does that require a green card? Does that require a citizenship paper?
You know, I, on one hand, I have to say absolutely. We have immigration laws, and they are there to not only protect our own homeland, but we have those laws in place so that way we can have a mature, responsible, and well-adjudicated system. Now, when those laws get proposed to be refined or fine-tuned, we shouldn't be afraid of that. We should have a built-for-purpose immigration system that allows America to benefit from the best and brightest and the most courageous in their pursuit from around the world.
But there are people in the United States, I'm thinking of Dreamers, there are undocumented people who, by virtue of their experience here and length of time here, have taken on precisely all these values, and that they can credibly answer the question in the affirmative that, yes, they are American enough, that American is an idea. America is not something I'm trying to be. It is what I am.
Absolutely. If you talk to the types of people that have had to, you know, whether they came here illegally or they came here legally, the amount of grit, resilience, and hard work that it takes to overcome adversities of the past, as well as make a productive life for yourself here, that is the fundamental American story. But more in a modern take, America is a story of those that we are at our collective best when we stare adversity in the face. And so we need to be able to understand where they are coming from in order to understand that we're all better off when we are all better off.
Do you have a moment when you were asked if you were American enough?
There was a time in which I was actually boarding a train, or sorry, it was a bus actually, from Washington D.C. to New York just to see some friends one weekend, and it was situated in a neighborhood that was really on the hustle and bustle of the sidewalks, all stripes of individuals walking up and down, but the individual on the train. On the bus, was actually not American-born. You could tell with a very thick accent. And the gentleman just didn't want to let me on. I had a ticket. I asked him what was wrong. As he was resisting me from entering the bus, other folks of other backgrounds and other skin colors were let on. But I wasn't. I can't tell you for sure whether he was judging my sense of Americanism, my sense of patriotism, or just I had bad breath that morning. I don't know. It could have been any number of things. But it's those types of feelings in which people feel excluded and actively are precluded from joining their fellow brother and sister in whether it's a bus ride or whether it's in a common discussion or whether it's in an opportunity to thrive in this nation. That's of really a big concern here. This ownership of country is as American as it gets. No one should feel like they shouldn't own a piece of it or own their values or their virtues in this country. That is everyone's right when they are here. But that sense of ownership should also be shared. That sense of ownership should be mutually discussed, debated, and iterated upon. And even if you and I disagree, that's the fundamental premise of being American.
Vikram Iyer, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Vikram Iyer is a former senior policy advisor to the Obama administration and former chief of staff for the U.S. Patent Trademark Office. We've been asking you what makes you American enough to escape being questioned about whether you belong here. A surprising question suddenly relevant today in American civic life.
This is Mark Mannheimer, and I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Being an American is something I have never really dwelled on till recently. My mother was an immigrant, but a citizen. I feel it has to do with who one is as an individual. Are you respectful and mindful of others? Do you value your community, your state, and the country? And are you willing to speak out, to vote, to enjoy and exercise our freedom?
To tweet is surely American, and one listener told us, to me it means freedom of the individual being protected at any cost, the liberty to be you, the idea that anyone can be anything. Or, being an American lets me experience other people's wide-ranging global perspectives through a free press and other media. What do you think? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or join us on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com and by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at ArkansasEDC.com.